And here's this very famous photograph. And I just looked at this thing. And I came unglued. I don't know how long I sat down on the curb, and I don't know if I was there for 15 minutes or an hour and a half, just had a breakdown, just crying, sobbing uncontrollably. All I could think was, it's not enough to send us halfway around the world to die. Now they're killing us in the streets of our own country. I have to do something. And I finally, whenever I finally cried myself out, I got up and I joined the anti-war movement.
That was former Marine Bill Earhart in episode 8 of the Vietnam War. The photo that turned Earhart into an anti-war activist was taken at Kent State University. You probably know it. John Filo, a photojournalism student at Kent State, was on campus on May 4, 1970. That day, the Ohio National Guard opened fire on students protesting the war. They killed 4 people, Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Shore, and William Knox Schroeder. 9 other students were also wounded. Filo captured Marianne Vecchio's agony as she kneeled over Miller's body. She was just 14 years old. Kent State wasn't the only American campus where students were killed during the Vietnam War. Students were shot at the University of California, Santa Barbara, as well as at Jackson State. The number of college students who died or were injured pales next to those who were killed and wounded in Vietnam. But the shootings at Kent State made it seem like America was fighting a war against its own citizens so it could continue fighting another war overseas. I'm Alyssa Rosenberg, and you're listening to The American War, a podcast about how America lost its way in Vietnam and how Ken Burns and Lynn Novick are trying to help us find our way back. I'm here with Ken to talk about the 8th episode of their documentary.
Several hundred angry, grieving students sat down and demanded to know why the guardsmen had fired on their friends.
Sir, you've got a couple hundred students there.
An officer ordered them to disperse or we will shoot again.
How long will you give us?
You've got 5 minutes.
Right now. Only the anguished pleas of geology professor Glenn Frank averted further tragedy.
Talk, Dr. Frank, talk. I am begging you right now, if you don't disperse right now, they're going to move in and there can only be a slaughter. Would you please listen to me? Jesus Christ, I don't want to be a part of this.
So, Ken, the first time I watched this episode, which ends with a long section on the Kent State Massacre, I was just so shocked by hearing the audio of Glenn Frank, who was the faculty marshal at Kent State, begging the students to disperse after the National Guard had shot and killed 4 people. I know when you were growing up, your dad was a professor at the University of Michigan. He was involved with the anti-war movement there. We've talked about that. What was it like to see the anti-war movement at colleges go from the first teach-in at Michigan to the massacres at Kent State and Jackson State? I mean, that must have felt incredibly strange just to see things change that much in that short a span of time.
I think just as we've discussed the impact of the photograph on the streets of Saigon in Tet, or the burning body of that little girl Kim Phuc running down the street from the mistake her own Air Force has committed on her and her fellow villagers, so too is the Kent State moment and the iconic photograph that issues from it. One of the important moments for me, it was just devastating. I think the colloquy of voices at the end of the film, people we've gotten to know and trust, were particularly dramatic and I think expressed what a lot of us felt. I certainly felt that too. They're killing us now.
Do you remember when you saw the picture?
Oh, yeah, I do. I remember it in the Ann Arbor News and the top of the fold and just, oh, my God. And it just seemed to have changed it in much the same way we sort of feel disassociated from what we would think would be normal courses of events today, and everything sort of laughs in the face of that. It was very disturbing. It was earth-changing. And in fact, to tell you the evolution, the mention of the death of those students was one line in the original draft of the script, and then went on a little bit to reactions to it and the shutting down of the campuses. And I had just coincidentally ended up invited by friends that I knew to give a talk at Kent State, and I went, and in my downtime they asked if I'd like to see a little permanent exhibit that they had put up, erected in one of the college buildings, and I went in, and it was so stunning and so beautifully done in a relatively small amount of space, and the imagery and the movies and the interpretation were so loving that I remember calling up Sarah Botstein and saying, look, we have to just expand this. I got to get somebody out here. You've got to hear this audio tape of the gunfire. You've got to hear this other thing. And so what was a mention and then a dismount became that very long set piece that is agonizing, because you realize so much of what happened really changed the color of the war. Now, having said that, I think part of what makes this scene so effective is the acknowledgement that a vast majority of Americans approved of the Guardsmen, that there was incredibly cruel, mail, hate mail and vilification of the people who died. And so there's an agony to this. There's a sense of almost just the tightening noose of this episode, and you begin to see in the form of the people that we've gotten to know, Bill Earhart, John Musgrave, others, just this incredible, this is it, this is what we're going to do, we have to change our lives.
Do you remember that sense that people blamed the students at the time, or was that something new to you?
It was new to me. I mean, maybe it's not new. It wasn't new to me at the time, but I had conveniently put Kent State and My Lai in these little neat little things, which I pretended to know about, but I had forgotten or never knew about the 20-month lag between when the news of My Lai broke and when it actually had taken place, just a few months after Tet. So, I mean, I think there's so many things that perhaps I'd been exposed to it, but in the way that we then quickly form a narrative or a description or some reductive way for us to neatly file it away, it becomes merely a kind of headline instead of an article, or it becomes a word instead of a sentence. I mean, the 68 Convention, which a presidential commission would later determine was a police riot, was in fact overwhelmingly approved by the American people, so much so that Nixon opened his campaign in the Chicago Loop, which was traditionally the home of Democratic labor. And that was an astute political decision on his part to sort of scoop up those votes that would have normally and almost reflexively gone Democratic. I mean, all I remember was being appalled at what had taken place night after night for those few nights at the Democratic convention. All of these things you begin to realize when you have the opportunity to pursue the facts and not just the theories or the arguments.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I have talked to everyone I'm working on this project with about, and I really struggle with this because I did a lot of protesting in college. I was the world's, sort of politest, meekest protester, but even so, and it never occurred to me in a million years when I was doing any of those things that I would be physically unsafe. And that speaks a lot to who I am, where I was going to school, but, when we were occupying the admissions office, this was in a fight over financial aid reform, the dean of the college came in and had herself filmed reading from the student handbook that, we could be in disciplinary trouble if we didn't leave, right? I mean, it was so polite. And so it never occurred to me that I could get hurt.
Well, this is what it is hard to contemplate. And I think that this scene very effectively, I'm as proud of that scene as anything, and I'm sure Lynn feels the same position, and the editor again, Tricia Reedy, was so extraordinary and delicate in the way we did it, that you have a sense of inhabiting what that must meant. I mean, it's now in our minds now with Charlottesville, which is if you were a student at the University of Virginia or someone committed to, you know, anti-hate groups, you might find yourself on a side street with a bunch of other people when all of a sudden a car comes racing down and kills you or severely wounds you. And up to that second, you would have realized that this was a very tense and charged confrontation, but wasn't going to become what it became.
I mean, I hate saying this, but I feel like the one thing that I've held on to is that it, you know, it was an individual. It was someone with an ideology. At least it wasn't the National Guard. At least it wasn't a police
That's
officer.
Right.
But I do
That's
brace
right.
for that point again.
Well, and we also, I mean, there's communities in our country that just the mere sight of a police officer is threatening.
Yeah.
You know, we're isolating something that took place, you know, 47 years ago. You know, African Americans are killed by police officers, you know, it seems like, you know, weekly in the United States.
Yeah.
And
they get blamed all of the time.
They're not innocent.
Yeah.
And nobody does it. And in Jackson State, which follows hard on the heels of Kent State, the students aren't even out protesting. You know, these are shots fired into the building, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I had never heard of Jackson State. Obviously, more people died at Kent State, but I just had never heard of that. And I felt like having that incident restored to the national consciousness is, I think, going to spark some difficult conversations for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I mean, I remembered it really very vividly. Since it was so soon after, it just felt like everything is coming undone. Just, I mean, the whole second half of the film, you know, particularly episodes 6, 7, 8, and 9, are just the tapestry seems so worn and frayed that at any moment you think the whole thing will unravel.
Kent State exists mostly as a photo for me. For Lynn Novick, it was one of her first encounters with the uproar Vietnam caused here at home.
I remember not really understanding what could have happened. Who's on the ground? Why is this girl upset? Wait, this happened on a college campus? Who, you know, how did this person get killed? Just, it didn't really make sense, but the intensity of that photograph probably represented for me as a young person coming of age all the agony of the Vietnam War in that one image.
I wanted to ask Lynn what it was like to go back and report Kent State all over again and why she and Ken told the story of the massacre the same way they recounted battles in Vietnam.
Like everything else about this project, working on the scene about Kent State was completely revelatory. I really didn't know much beyond the photograph and the most basic information of the story. And the parts of it that were most stunning to me were understanding the backstory that led up to it, the position of the Ohio governor, why he brought in the National Guard, why they were given live ammunition, how poorly they were trained, where they had come from. That the ROTC building had been burned down and that had created such tumult on campus. All of those things I did not know. And, you know, most shocking was the public reaction to the killings at Kent State, that the preponderance of public opinion was supporting the National Guard and against the students who had been killed and their families and the protesters. I found that very, very surprising. I had no idea that that was how that particular event unfolded, you know, when it happened.
I was wondering why you thought Jackson State has retained a less prominent place in American historical memory. I mean, even though college students died there too, is it that there wasn't that kind of photographic image that made it stick in people's minds?
I suspect it's the fact that you don't have the iconic photograph and that these are African Americans who were killed and their lives in our society generally do not seem to carry the same weight. And that's tragic upon tragic. And also, I think the narrative of what happened there was slightly more confusing. and less clear-cut than what happened at Kent State in terms of just what the events, the facts of what happened. But I suspect it's primarily the lack of a photograph and the racial identity of the students.
One of the things you did in this section of the episode is you walk viewers through Kent State sort of in the same way you take them through a battle in Vietnam. You have the descriptions of the terrain, the explanations of the National Guard's maneuvers. That seemed like a really clear, intentional choice. Do you think the audience learned something important about Kent State by seeing it as a military maneuver rather than just as some sort of tragic accident?
It seemed important to represent the war coming home in that way, in that you had violence, you had munitions, you had opposing sides, you had misunderstandings, and you had chaos on the campus of Kent State. And all of those things were also happening in Vietnam. And it feels as though you have these sort of two parallel threads on a collision course, and that's where they meet, you know, in 1970 in Ohio. And that's such a fulcrum, such a turning point of the war, that to not understand that it was a battle as much as the battles that were happening in Vietnam seemed to misrepresent what actually happened. Mike Welch, our co-producer, tracked down a student who had been on the campus and had a camera that day or had been filming the protest over the last few days and kept the camera rolling while this carnage was happening and was actually quite disturbed by what he had seen and put the footage in the garage and didn't want to look at it again. And it was a very circuitous process. It took about a year, but Mike was able to track down the family, and they were willing to share with us all the reels of film that were shot. And we had it all remastered and then used some shots that really have, I don't know, have never been seen, but hardly ever been seen.
And what was the process of talking to the family about that?
You know, I would rather have Mike do it. Mike is right here. I can ask him. I don't know the answer to that. Okay, hold on 1 second.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well.
Thank you for being pulled into this momentarily. We're grateful.
Of course.
See, so I would love to know sort of the story behind that home video footage, if you don't mind sharing it. It's really interesting.
Sure. So we were doing a lot of research at all of the networks, including CBS. And CBS had sort of traces of this footage from Kent State, but they didn't know where it came from. They had broadcast it, I think, you know, immediately following the event, but the records of sort of where it had originated were lost. So we kind of just started asking questions. They couldn't license it to us, obviously, if they didn't know where it came from. And we had been in touch with some people who had been at Kent State at the time and were still sort of active in discussion groups online. And one of them, very helpfully, by pure serendipity, he happened to be, like, contacted by someone recently who, long story short, said, I think I may know who shot that footage. And there was a student, David Klein, who was at Kent State. He was a journalism student, and he was doing some camera work on the side for the networks. And the Kent State thing was a big deal, and they were covering it for a few days before the shooting. So he had been shooting this for the local CBS affiliate. My understanding is then he was going to make his own film, and for whatever reason he didn't. But his brother, who is caring for David Klein now, Ray Klein is the brother, we were able to get in touch with him, and Ray sent us a box. He said, this might have what you have, you know, what you're looking for. And this box arrived via FedEx, and we opened it, and there were, like, you know, 10 cans of 16 millimeter footage that hadn't been touched since, you know, in 40 years or whatever it was. So that was really exciting. We then went and had it transferred, and the footage was incredible because it's this footage. David Klein was right there on the field with these kids as this event is happening, and it's stunning. It's stunning to sort of unpack a box that literally you can just tell it hasn't been looked at for these decades, and then this magic happens when the film gets processed and digitized, and you see it, and it's this incredible and horrible event.
Well, thank you so much. That's really useful. Can I have Lynn back?
Yeah, of course. I'll give you back to Lynn.
Thanks.
Hold
a lot,
on one
Mike.
Second.
Perfect. Okay, much better.
No, that's yeah. That's so helpful.
Yeah, it takes a village here, everybody.
It's a good village. So we talked about that footage, but you also have something I hadn't seen before, which And again, correct me if I'm wrong here. It looks like you have the photos John Filo took of Marianne Vecchio and Jeffrey Miller leading up to the shot that is sort of the iconic shot. Were those...
The whole series of photographs, right, exactly.
Were those in archives? I mean, obviously...
Well, I should go get Salima. She could tell you. I mean, I think it's Associated Press, but I'm not 100% sure, and we often do a deep dive and, you know, ask for the pictures that come before and after the iconic image. So, you know, that's pretty standard for us, is that we don't want to see just the picture that everybody knows. We want to see what came before and after. And I'm pretty sure those, that whole series, it's a sequence, was all taken by the same photographer.
And you know. So, you know, with this picture in particular, was there something you felt like you understood or could contextualize about that famous image from seeing all those pictures in sequence?
Well, one of the things for me about that image is that it's so often reproduced. I had never really seen fully the expression on her face and the details of what's on her shirt and the pool of blood and just all of that. It was much more vivid. So I felt that I was seeing it for the first time. But, I, you know, something happens when you have the opportunity to see what's before and after an iconic moment like that, where it's almost, you know, the equivalent today of what we would say virtual reality, where you look around and you can see what's outside the frame. And you understand that there's a much broader world and different reality than the one that's just encapsulated in the within the lines of the photograph that you're so familiar with. So it becomes real in a different way.
I wanted to circle back to sort of what you said earlier about bringing the war home or the war coming home. Because I think something I'm still struggling with is just how we got to a place where National Guard officers and cops were shooting and killing students on college campuses. I mean, what does that mean?
You know, I mean, it is in a context, you know, we would have to rewind that back to the earlier 60s and the civil rights movement and the protests and the ways that those mass demonstrations sometimes were suppressed and there was violence perpetrated on marchers and demonstrators who were peacefully protesting with hoses and dogs, and people were shot at, and there were assassinations, and there was, you know, a kind of violent impulse to control, and there was a reaction to it in the anti-war movement as well. There was a violent streak of bombings and vandalism and destruction that was perpetrated by a tiny fringe minority, but got a lot of attention in the press and was exploited very successfully by the political establishment to sort of sow the seeds of fear and rancor and mistrust, and to accuse the people who were against the war of being unpatriotic and violent and destructive. What was disturbing, most disturbing to us in putting that scene together and understanding it in the context was, I think we would hope that the people who are in charge would know something about de-escalating and calming people down and helping to diffuse tension and let people speak and be heard without letting things get out of control. That did not happen at Kent State.
The anti-war movement was part of a larger wave of social change happening in the United States. And though soldiers in Vietnam were far from home, they too felt the impact of those movements. Some American veterans joined the anti-war movement when they got home. Others embraced the civil rights movement and black power, women's liberation, and the environmental movements. General Merrill McPeak, who later served as chief of staff for the Air Force, was one of them. I talked to him about how he ended up supporting some of these causes and his perspective as a career military man on the role of protests in our society.
You know, the military, the uniformed military is not a monolithic, right-wing, ultra-conservative outfit. They are, by and large, politically conservative, as am I, by the way. But my point is, it's not automatic that you sign up with the conservative right-wing of the Republican Party just because you're a general officer, although a lot of them are. But a lot of them are not. And I guess I wasn't signed up with anybody. I just looked at a cause like the protection of the environment and said, yeah, why should we poison the air we're breathing? I mean, you know, who wants to do that? Hold up your hand. And why are we against rights for everybody, including black people in this country? And why are we for putting some sort of glass ceiling on women? We can use all the talent we have in this country.
You know, you've talked about feeling sympathetic with these movements and also feeling like you were in Vietnam in part to protect protesters' freedoms. How did you feel about
Absolutely.
The way protesters were being treated at home while you were in Vietnam?
Look, I believe in a vigorous debate. I don't believe in killing students at Kent State or the police riot that happened in Chicago during the Democrat political convention. So there needs to be limits. I think that the opposition to protest was quite ugly in some cases. And what I would say is that these people were not unpatriotic, which was what they were accused of by the so-called silent majority. They were just expressing their patriotism in another way, in a different way, in a way different than I expressed mine. And I'm all for it. And I'm all for you opposing the way they expressed their patriotism. But I don't think you should get out of billy club and go beat up on them.
At Kent State, the Vietnam War came home to the United States in a way that was impossible to ignore. Members of the National Guard, which is supposed to protect Americans, killed Americans. And not by accident, but because they were acting like an occupying army on a college campus. It was an extreme incident, but one that still has implications today, especially with mass protests happening all over the United States. One of the things that's frightening about this moment is the sense that we still haven't resolved questions Vietnam raised about what acceptable protest looks like, and who we should blame when the government responds to protests with violence. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please take some time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Share with friends and family, and find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you want to know more about the documentary, go to washingtonpost.com/theamericanwar and follow me on Twitter at Alyssa Rosenberg. This podcast is produced by Carol Alderman and Adriana Usera, with art direction from Chris Rucan. I'm Alyssa Rosenberg. This is The American War.
If you like The American War, you should check out some of our other great podcasts, like Cape Up with Jonathan Capehart, where Jonathan brings you the voices you need to hear on the topics you try to avoid. Or try Constitutional, a series about how people have framed and reframed the Constitution over time, from host Lillian Cunningham. You can find these shows anywhere you listen to podcasts and learn more online at washingtonpost.com/podcasts.
The Washington
Post.